Good morning. Christmas came early to our neighbours this week when on Wednesday, the UK became the first Western country to approve a vaccine for COVID-19. As they say in scientific circles, wowzers. Here's Claire with Linda Bald, Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh.
Good morning. We weren't expecting this today, were you?
No, I mean, I've been expecting it, Claire, very soon, but the MHRA has moved incredibly quickly. Now, this medicines regulator has been looking at the data, not just from the Pfizer-BioNTech trial, but others as well for the vaccines throughout the process. So it's not as if they got all the papers last week and have made a rushed decision. They've done this very carefully, but they've done it as quickly as they could.
Yeah, the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, was asked about this in the last little while, and it says that it's longer approval process for COVID-19 vaccines, and we're the ones who will be using their approval process here, was safer than that used by Britain.
I guess I would contest that. I mean, the EMA is, of course, a hugely respected regulator, but also quite complex just in terms of its broader remit. You're looking at a single country. The MHRA is regarded internationally as an incredibly robust medicines regulator. So I think we need to take their decision on trust, given their track record.
Well, one professor happy to take it on trust was James McInerney, head of the School of Life Sciences at the University of Nottingham. And he spoke to Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland.
This is just such good news today. I'm so pleased. I'm so delighted. And in particular, I'm so pleased about two things in this vaccine. One is that it's so safe. The number of adverse reactions to it have been very, very low, and they've been very small adverse reactions, like some people have reported a headache or a reddening in the area around where the vaccine was administered. But after 43,000 people involved in a clinical trial, I mean, there's been nothing more serious than that, zero. And the second thing to say is that it's a vaccine that's that doesn't seem to decrease in efficacy in older populations. And so it looks like it's going to be a vaccine that works quite well for everybody that can be vaccinated. And so, you know, it's just such a great day.
But what do you say to the doubters? And there will be doubters. Mm. You know, for example, this type of vaccine, I understand, has never been approved for use in humans before.
This is true. This is true. So, just on that particular point, the vaccine is based on what's called messenger RNA, mRNA. So that doesn't matter what that really is. It's very like DNA, but not quite. This is thought to be a much safer way to produce a vaccine than the older ways, which quite often involved, you know, killed whole virus and so on, which would work fine. But this particular way is much more precise, and you know, it's by design, and we thought to have fewer adverse reactions to it. And the clinical trial data came back saying that this looks like, at least for the COVID version of it, this looks like it's very, very true. I'm not terribly worried about the technology. It should be. It's a very modern technology. It's very, very new, as you said. But it has been trialed now. It's not that it's untrialed. It has been trialed. And what I'd say to anybody that's wondering about all of this is maybe just get your hands on all of the numbers, you know, that have been produced. They're all available to us all. 43,000 people would, you know, go a long way to fill in Croke Park.
James McInerney on Morning Ireland. So if the UK have it, how far behind are we? Well, on the News at One, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly spoke about our preparedness for vaccinations and the timeline given to him by the European Medicines Agency, the EMA.
So from the start of October, the EMA has been doing a rolling review of three of the vaccines, from AstraZeneca, Pfizer and Moderna. Yesterday, Pfizer and Moderna submitted their applications to the EMA for market authorisation. And yesterday, the EMA also announced that they're starting a rolling review of another vaccine from a company called Janssen. And so what Eimear Cook has said is, if the applications are sufficiently robust and complete, an EMA opinion for their marketing authorisation within the EU could be issued within weeks. Specifically, she said, for the Pfizer vaccine, which is the one the UK are talking about, it's called the Scientific Committee for Human Medicines. They plan to conclude their assessment and give an opinion during what's called an extraordinary meeting. And that's scheduled at the latest for the 29th of December. And then secondly, Brian, she said for the Moderna vaccine, the same committee plans to conclude its assessment during an extraordinary meeting, and that has been tentatively scheduled for the 12th of January. So if, for example, the EMA authorised on the 29th of December, we would have a final authorisation here by the HPRA. So within days, essentially what I'm told is that quite like the UK, it's taking sort of 7 to 10 days from authorisation to distribution. The view is that in Ireland it would be about the same.
Oh, a potentially very happy new year to us. That was Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on Wednesday's News at One. Reaction. Well, on Drive Time, two texts encapsulated both ends of the spectrum.
As soon as a vaccine is available, I'll be top of the queue. I haven't seen my only brother since March because he's immunocompromised, and my wife is a frontline A&E nurse, and I would love the freedom to give him a well-deserved bear hug and spend the evening talking nonsense over a few drinks, as one listener. But an opposing view from a listener says, no way would I take a dubious, fast-tracked vaccine for something that has a 99.8% recovery rate. Do not forget that these companies are exempt from liability madness.
Well, Cormac put this to Dr. Gabriel Scally, public health physician and visiting professor of public health at the University of Bristol.
You heard the text I read from one dubious listener. Is it possible, I wonder at all, that the UK regulator came under intense political pressure to speed up the approval process?
I think all of us working in the field of dealing with COVID are under intense pressure from all sorts of sources. We want to do the best for our population. But these people who are involved in the regulatory process have been involved in this business for a very long time, have built up a huge amount of experience. And I personally would trust them that to do their job properly. I don't think they would be amenable to political process. And in the UK, it's actually been subject to two sets of review, both the MHRA, the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, but also the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, which has produced its guidance today. And they say they have reviewed all of the data and are very positive about what they've found. They say it looks very good indeed. And I think that is, you know, they say the vaccine appears to be safe and well tolerated, and there were no clinically concerning safety observations.
I don't know if this is a fair question to answer, but would you be in the queue to get the vaccine now?
Oh, I would be head of the queue.
Top of the
queue.
Don't
you worry. As soon as my age group comes up, I will be there.
Gabriel Scally with the arm out. But what have vaccines ever done for us? Well, here's Alton Power, Professor of Molecular Virology at Queen's University in Belfast, on the News at One.
Brian, I want to reiterate very, very strongly is the major success that vaccines have had on our lives in the last century. We've ended up with the eradication of smallpox. Poliovirus is virtually non-existent in the Western world, and we've had major impact on measles, mumps, rubella, and a whole list of other diseases that were the scourges of our parents' and our grandparents' time. So this is the first thing to say, that vaccines have had and continue to have a major impact on infectious diseases. Specifically relating to this COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, the technology that was used to generate these vaccines has been under research and development for several years before we even knew about the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And basically what has happened is had what we term a plug-and-play system, whereby we identified very rapidly the antigen, the part of the virus that's likely to induce a good protective immune response very early on. And that's based on previous work that was done with the first SARS virus, SARS-CoV-1, in 2002 to 2003, and the MERS virus, coronavirus, from 2012. So it's not like we came into this completely in the dark.
Professor Alton Power. And here to finish is CEO of the Health Products Regulatory Authority, Dr. Lorraine Nolan, on Thursday's News at One.
Probably one of the most important things that I do need to say to you is that these vaccines will have to meet the exact same standards as any vaccine will have. There will be no compromise or lowering the bar for these vaccines. So they will have to meet the same standards for safety, and the same standards with regard to effectiveness and quality, and they will be reviewed to that. And just important to say that, you know, for any medicine and for vaccines as well, the regulatory oversight does not just end with a marketing approval. We continuously monitor the safety of the use of medicines and vaccines when they are go into the marketplace. And we can expect with these vaccines that, you know, they will follow the typical profile of any vaccine. There will be effects. These will be mild in nature. And people will be familiar with these in terms of, you know, injection site reactions, for example, maybe mild fever. But when the vaccines are introduced onto the marketplace, they will be supported with intensive monitoring and rigorous monitoring. And the reason why we do this is to ensure that they, what we expect for the vaccine from the clinical trials is what happens from the experience of its use in the real world setting.
Dr. Lorraine Nolan. Now, we're not there yet, but 2021? Dare we hope? Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was great kindness and charity to be heard on the radio this week, but also very real sadness and cruelty. On Monday, Ryan spoke to conductor David Brophy, and in the course of that chat, David talked about being bullied in school.
It was rough. I found it difficult.
Did you get beaten up?
Oh, God, a lot.
Why?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I presume I was different. And of course, the fact like I played piano and I sang in a choir. And then also, I remember I got slagged off because my father gave me, this sounds terrible, but he gave me his sister's old, you know, the old music cases with the bar that goes over, like, they, you know, and you can just see in a particular context, you know.
Mm. Was it relentless?
I felt it was relentless. Mm. It might not have been, you know, but I felt it was relentless. So I don't know. I mean, obviously that kind of shaped me, the type of person I was. And I probably became, like most teenagers, quite introverted, I'd say. Mm. But I had a guy when I was about 10, there was a guy in my, and he wasn't in my class, he was in the school though, who repeatedly threatened to hang me for like not just 6 months, but for a couple of years. And of course, I was probably 9 or 10 at the time. I utterly believed it. Utterly believed it.
Of course
you
did.
And so you don't recover from that very easily, you know. And that doesn't leave you.
It's really interesting that, you know, it to me, it informs why you have such a kind streak in you.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
the way you deal with people is really...
I would say it's complex. And I'd say probably only the past few years that I'd be kind of willing to admit that kind of bullying and what I put up with in school probably shapes a little bit of who the person I am nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, and probably for many years through my 20s and probably all my 30s, I wouldn't have even referred to it, you know. But maybe I think just for some reason the past few years, I think I've kind of, even for myself, said, actually, this was a thing that happened to you, Dave, when you were younger, and actually is part of your life.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of shaped the person I am now, for good or bad. It has had,
well,
an
for good,
on me, you
I
know?
Think.
And it doesn't... well, not all the time, you know, but like everyone has their good and bad
That's
points,
true.
You know. But I think it never goes away. I can only...
In what way?
It's just, I certainly remember, you know, I will never forget all the occasions when one of the kids said to me, I'm going to hang you. And to leave and to come home and to, you know, as all kids, everyone lives with their own thoughts and lives in their own heads. And you come home and I said to my folks, but, you know, it doesn't leave you. And your folks,
yeah,
my folks were fantastic and they reassured you all the time. But then you meet the same person a few weeks later and do the same thing. And they know they're having an impact on you because they know that you're vulnerable in some way. And that's what it's about, you know. But when you utterly believe it, and I did many days and I was terrified.
Conductor David Brophy with Ryan on Monday. On Tuesday, Ray spoke to Samantha Long. She'd written a story for their anthology, A Page from My Life. She's adopted, and her story was about giving birth to her own son 17 years ago and the sadness and anger she'd felt at her own birth mother's situation. Now, growing up in Dublin with her twin sister Etta, Samantha wasn't overly interested in getting in touch with her birth mother, but this didn't stop her from having an idea of who she might be.
I always thought she'd be a woman who lived in Raheny and had a few children and a dog and a cat.
Okay.
But that wasn't...
And just that you came along at a difficult time in her life or
whatever. Yeah, just that she was very young and unmarried and and had a boyfriend and wasn't able to take care of us. But none of that was true.
And you were happy enough with that notion, that fantasy notion in your head.
It was kind of a women's magazine type notion, painted or like a Maeve Binchy style notion or something. But yeah, I was convinced that she had moved on and thought about us and we thought about her, but that she had a whole new family and that maybe she hadn't told anyone about us. But
So your dad and Etta were pushing on and went through the avenues. Right up until near the meeting, you were still not going to go.
I wasn't going, no. I wasn't going.
And what swung it for you?
My sister Etta said to me in the weeks leading up to it, we're twins, you can't send 50%.
Right.
You can't send half the set.
And after counselling for Samantha and her sister and their birth mother, they did indeed meet. The year was 1995.
Where was the meeting arranged?
It was in the lovely Gresham Hotel, which was coincidentally just around the corner from where she had lived all those years,
yes,
in Sean McDermott Street Laundry, which is called Gloucester Street Laundry as well.
Yeah.
But people like her never got to go into the Gresham.
No. But she was there that day.
She was there that day. It was like kind of an afternoon tea meeting where we all had tea and coffee and cake. Yeah, she was there first.
Sitting down
in a polyester dress that looked like it was from a charity shop and a navy handbag with nothing in it. There was nothing in her bag. It was just a prop.
And that was significant. It became more significant the more you found out about her life.
Yeah, because I suppose we were these 23-year-old girls in 1995. I mean, as it happens, the first time Etta and I ever voted was for Mary Robinson, just as an example. So we were living in this kind of more liberated time for Irish women, where you felt you could do anything. And we met this woman who had given birth to us, who had just been a victim of so many denials in her life. And as the penny dropped, you know, with us, we were just absolutely stunned. And it took us a long time to process what she didn't have and what we did.
Samantha's mother's name was Margaret, and it would turn out that her life was one of almost unrelenting hardship. Born in the 50s, her own mother suffered from postnatal depression, and she was in and out of Grange Gorman Mental Hospital all of her life. One of seven children, Margaret's father was reported for neglect, and she was sent to High Park Industrial School in Drumcondra at the age of two. She was never again to leave state institutions, and Margaret died at the age of 51. Samantha talked about getting to know her birth mother and her story and the complexity of their relationship.
It was like you'd heard of this aunt in a home or something like that, and you were eventually going to meet this aunt. So it felt like meeting an aunt that you'd never known. And because she was so vulnerable and institutionalised, we never tried to delve too deep because she was inferior. She felt a little bit inferior to us, and we knew that. So we just wanted to make her feel as special as she could while we knew her. So it was really an on-off relationship because it was heavy going. You know, any time we visited her, we were going into this, you know, what I felt was an unfriendly environment in the institution. And What did we have to offer her, really? We weren't going to take her out to live with us or anything. We were just starting our lives.
Was that ever broached? Was that ever suggested?
By her?
Yeah.
After my adoptive mum, Anne, died in 1999, Margaret, I think, understandably, saw kind of a gap in the market and did ask if she could, you know, be our mum and come out and live with us. But it just wasn't possible, and we didn't have the skills to take care of her. So, you know, people have said that too. You could have taken her out. She wasn't able for the world that we live in.
They would learn that Margaret had been raped and was unable to come to terms with that event or the birth of her twins and later another child. And one day that trauma came to a head.
There used to be hairdressing apprentice young girls came in to blow dry the hair of the women in the laundry. Every couple of weeks, and they were kind of trying out blow dries on them.
Oh yeah, they were students.
They were students, yes. Yeah. Gosh. And I know, all dressed up and nowhere to go. So Margaret was having her hair blow dried in front of a mirror with the trainee hairdresser, and she just began to have a mental breakdown looking at herself in the mirror, and she started to scream that her babies were taken away from her. And at that moment, the hairdresser told the social worker that she was just inconsolable and it had just dawned on her that her twins had been taken away 23 years before that, at the age of 7 weeks.
It's just...
I know.
It's heartbreaking, isn't
it? I know, it's really a shocking denial of a life, and her life was not lived.
Yeah.
And that's why we told her story, you know, a number of times over the years, to just to spotlight one woman who went through so much, and she had no education, no pay, no family, no love, and no babies, because they were taken away as well.
So you were 21, knowing you were adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 23, that hadn't changed. But now you knew that you were, you know, a product of rape, and that your mother was an institutionalised woman in her 40s.
Yeah.
How does that change how you think about the world?
It makes me very grateful for the freedoms that I have. It makes me understand that nobody asks to be born, no matter what the circumstances of their birth or their conception. And it makes me feel so incredibly lucky for the life that I have now.
Samantha Long with Ray on Tuesday. And on Thursday, we learned that the report by the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes will be published in January. Now, after such heartbreak and pain, here is a bright, shining example of the difference one person of integrity and kindness can make in a life. On Monday's Liveline, Jer Smith rang into Joe to talk about a theft from his mother, who has schizophrenia and is living in a HSC facility. But in the course of that conversation, he spoke about growing up in Ballymun.
It was very hard for it to cope. We weren't the quietest of kids, Joe, you know. Like, we were wild when we were younger. Like, yeah. There was three boys, we were always fighting with each other, and, you know, like, normal, always wanting stuff.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Like, still at the end of the day, like, she had a schizophrenia, Joe, but she still brought me out to Smithfield and brought me horses when I was a young kid to occupy me. Brought me, you know, she always filled out, she always gave us what, everything she could give us, Joe, you know? And so that kind of instilled in us, like, so when my ma did go, we could have took advantage of having a flat and having our friends in and stuff, and it was like, no, we had a, you know, we learned an awful lot from her mother for the time we had with her, like.
When Jer was 13, his mother became so unwell she had to leave the house to get proper help, leaving Jer, his twin brother, and his older brother, only 14, essentially running their house, with the help of a woman who would turn out to be a godsend.
We were very lucky when it happened, when my mammy got sick, because there was a home help came in, and the home help was just absolutely phenomenal. Like, she would come in and, no, in the morning time, make sure you're up for school, make sure you're doing things, come in, make sure we were paying our bills, we were fed and stuff, and taught us real qualities in life, you know. It wasn't qualities as in, go out there and grab all the money you can and do it. It was qualities as in, you know, you've had a hard life, and I hope it's humbled you. So it was
what,
whenever...
she come in the morning?
Come in the morning and make sure we were up, getting on, you know, getting out of school. Yeah. I'd never gone well in school, so I went done a course. So she made sure we went to that.
Brilliant.
And she rewarded us then by,
did she ever give out? Well, did she give out to you, Jer?
There was times we had our ups and downs, you know, but she never left us. She, you know, as hard as we were, she'd never leave us. She'd always say, look, and now that's how it is. And, you know, like, it was, you know what, Joe, we were very, very lucky. We knew it from day one. We were very lucky. We knew of everybody who was in our flat the day our mammy went, the one person we could trust there was Anne, and she was the only one who never left any of us. Who never left us. Everybody else just done their job and got on with it. Just actions speak louder than words, and, you know, time. That's what I mean. Time is very, very, very precious and valuable, because the time that lady gave us, like, we would have never seen past 6 months.
And that woman was Anne Thomas, or to be precise, Sister Anne Thomas.
We found out she was a nun years later. She never wanted us to look down on her, look at her any different because she was a nun. And, you know, like, it's a mad story, Joe. It's a crazy story, but that lady was just like an angel. That, you know, she was just meant to be there at the right time. And
she was little sister of the Assumption, who were in Harold's Cross.
Yeah. And she worked for Sophia Housing. So Sophia Housing was like an agency that worked with disadvantaged people and stuff, you know, just families finding it hard and stuff.
And Chair, what did you didn't know she was a nun for a start?
No, so we never knew until one time we went to one, she brought us to one of our mother's players out in Portrand, my sister, and she was praying, and my brother asked, "Are you a nun?" Like, and she was like, "Ah, you know, like she never really, she was a very private woman, but she was always there for the right times, and she always, you know, like, just made sure we had everything we needed, you know. Like, I got into the toy boxing, and like, she'd always make sure that your money would be there at the end of the, you know, in the evening when you were going training. This because it was keeping you out of trouble, you know. And so you wouldn't be handed the money neither, Joe. It'd be like,
I know.
Did you do X, Y, and Z? Did you go to your course? You go, yeah, right, grand, and away with you then. So
oh, no messing there. Now, Ger is 30 and his mother never did return to the family home. And he talked about the sadness of growing up without their mother in the house.
It's hard in those 17 years, like, since she's gone, like, you know, the separation's been horrible, Joe, you know, for a family. If it wasn't for, like, Anne Thomas, that lady, like, we wouldn't have been able to, you know, she made sure we kept contact with her and would have brought us up to see her, you know, for birthdays, graduations, you know, any sort of stuff like that. Like, she made sure we had something there, and it was nice. Like, I take none away from my own aunties and uncles as well. They were there as well. Like, they popped in and made sure we were all right and that. But the real situation of it is, Joe, like, when this happened, it happened in the blink of an eye, and we never thought we'd see 17 years down the road as to where she's still on the medication, she's still in this place.
And for Juror, all of this was about quiet acts of kindness that could make all the difference.
What was Christmas like for the three of you living on your own in that flat, 14?
Well, my ma, Anne had always make sure my ma, like, Anne had a nice soft spot for my ma, so Anne had always make sure it was all organised for my ma to come home, like, and Anne had come in and she'd help us cook. Like, on Christmas Day, Anne would be with us on Christmas Day, and, you know, make sure that you had everything, like, and, you know, like, she get me ma's money off me ma and say, right, I'm going to bring them out and get them that Christmas clothes, Trish. And me ma just, you know what, she was, even though me ma's in there a long time, she done an awful lot for me, mammy. I think of everybody on the face of the planet who's ever done that for me ma, I think she's done the most for me ma in her whole life, for that, as an individual, like, and...
Ger, your mother is a remarkable woman. Obviously, Sister Anne was a remarkable woman. Your family, would you say there's six of you in total?
Six of us, yeah.
Remarkable. You should see, you'll be embarrassed. I won't read them out to you. You should see the stuff that's coming in about you, Ger Smith. Your wisdom and your maturity and your goodness. You'll be mortified.
It's the only way of paying back. It's the only way of paying. You know, when someone does, people looked after my ma for a long time. You can't go in there and physically pay them or give them a hug and say thanks very much, show them how much it means to you. The only way of doing that, Joe, is to also do what they're doing. You know, and not for gratitude, not for the pat on the back, not for nothing. If there's something you can do for someone, just do it without saying anything, without doing that, and just do it. And it's an act of kindness. Imagine we lived in a society, Joe, where acts of kindness weren't for posting on Facebook and bigging yourself up around like that. It was just for you, to big you up.
Okay.
You know, we all have an energy, Joe. Like, it could be a positive energy, a negative energy. And, you know, I think the situation we were put in, like, the cards we were dealt, you know, definitely gave us energy, like, and the energy it gave us.
Well, Ger, you've given us, you've given our listeners an incredible amount of energy and uplift today. Thank you so much, Ger Smith.
Ooh, something in my eye. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The toy show over, all round Tuberty wants now, is for the year to end.
It's the 1st of December, it's happening. If this means that eventually 2020 will be over, imagine. Just this month and then... gone.
Oh, I know what he means. But one man making the very most of his time left is Donald Trump. Here's Brian O'Donovan on Morning Ireland.
In the final weeks of a president's term, there are always lots of pardons being issued by presidents going back years. Last week, Donald Trump pardoned his former national security adviser, Michael Flynn. Reports this week that the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is inquiring about a pardon for himself. Reports, too, that President Trump has inquired about possible preemptive pardons for his children, Ivanka, Eric and Don Jr. and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Lots of reports as well, Gavin here as well. Lots of speculation that maybe Donald Trump may even look into pardoning himself.
One for everyone in the audience.
Someone might need an elf on the shelf in the Oval Office. And perhaps one in Downing Street too, because Brexit is hotting up. Here is political editor of the Financial Times, George Parker, with Anya on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Really, you've got the Tory Eurosceptics who think that any concession to Brussels is a betrayal of national sovereignty. And on the other side, pushing Michel Barnier, you've got people like President Macron who want to maintain a very big share of the fish in British territorial waters. And so those are the big sort of two things that are basically hanging in the balance, really. It's sort of fish versus sovereignty. And, you know, both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Macron face their own political pressures at home. But nevertheless, I still think that we are getting into a sort of landing zone area. And there's going to have to be a big bust-up. Of course, there always is at the end of a negotiation. But my sense is we're getting closer.
We'll wait and see. It's been a long time, George. Thank you very much.
That it has. And staying with Morning Ireland, earlier in the week, Audrey Carvel was in the horrors when she spoke to Dr. Michelle Dugon, zoologist with NUIG, about the noble false widow spider.
Oh gosh, I'm really sorry to our listeners to have to be talking about this morning. Where do we encounter these spiders, Michelle? Are these the spiders in our beds?
Yes, so I don't want to scare your listener too much, but yes, indeed, it's most of the people that have reported bites have been actually bitten either in their bed while sleeping, so they would turn over and squash the spider defend itself and bites, or when getting dressed in the morning. So a spider find its way in, let's say, the pair of trousers that you've left at the bottom of the bed the night before. You put your trousers
okay.
on. You get bitten and there you go.
It's all over. Oh my goodness.
Ugh, creepy. Meanwhile, down in Waterford, this is how hurler John Milan celebrated their win against Kilkenny.
Watching at home last night, a little fella's two, probably doesn't understand what's going on. We're jumping up and down, we're biting our fingernails, we're praying. And next thing, Jack Fagan grabs the ball. Hand passes into to Darragh Lyons. Darragh Lyons goes and sticks the ball in the back of the net. The wife jumps up, boy jump up, nearly hit the ceiling. The little fella goes flying into the Christmas tree, starts bursting out crying. and it's when he gets to maybe 10 or 12 or 13 years of age, I'll be able to tell him, yeah, that was the moment your mother threw you into the Christmas tree and just had a ball
of
crying.
Baby and Christmas tree still intact at the end
of it. It was. He calmed down after the final whistle, but I mean, it was just epic last night, Darren. You know, I mean, to beat your rivals, the year that's seen it. I mean, Waterford, the next 2 weeks in Waterford is just going to be incredible.
Yeah,
Sunday Sports' Darren Frahill wondering if it's going to be a lot of kids dangling off Christmas trees down in Waterford. And maybe Mayo.
Mayo have won a first Connacht title in 5 years. They've introduced new players. Their style of football is admirable. They work hard. They run hard. Durkin and Owen McLaughlin have been outstanding. They've introduced new players up front. Ryan O'Donoghue, Tommy Conroy, Aidan O'Shea at the edge of the square. But it's in the forward line, Des, that the focus will again be on for Mayo. It's that question mark. Do you have full confidence in them? I think the Tipperary backs were brilliant against Cork, but I don't think Cork asked the questions that Mayo will ask. And I think Mayo will win it, Des. I think this year anything's possible. Tip, maybe, but Mayo for me.
Oh, poor Tip. The superb Tomás O'Shea on Friday's Morning Ireland. Up Mayo. Over on Arena on Wednesday, they had a special programme to mark the annual publication of Winter Papers. And Sean talked to Louise Kennedy about her story.
Say it for me, first of all, and then explain it to me.
In bulk. In bulk.
So it's, I guess it's the Irish word for St. Bridget's Day, or that feast that sort of happens on or coincides with St. Bridget's Day, the first day of spring.
And spring is a time of reawakening. It's a time of rebirth. It's a time of great hope. Mm-hmm. Not in your story.
No, that's probably fair to say. All right. Yeah. It's. I guess it's about a failing farm and a marriage that's in a bit of trouble as well.
Potential infidelities are possibilities here because your two characters here are you have Elaine is the pregnant mother who's narrating, not Elaine Feeney.
No, Elaine. I have to say it's not absolutely not Elaine Feeney. Yeah.
Your fictional character Elaine is the.
It's a very unfortunate coincidence tonight.
It's all coming out.
Yeah. pregnant mother narrating this story. Liam is her husband, but the real problem here is Stacey Rainey.
Stacey Rainey.
The young one down the road who's up to give a hand.
Yeah. So it's set sort of during the lambing. So Elaine is heavily pregnant and also lugging a kind of oversized baby that's already born around the place. It's snowing and her husband is holed up in a lambing shed with a kind of implausibly glamorous 19-year-old in leopard print Wellingtons.
Leopard print Wellingtons. Elaine Feeney, do you have leopard print Wellingtons?
I bet she has.
I grew up on a farm. I wouldn't be seen dead in those kind of things, but I did love the story. Yeah.
Stacey Rainey, she even sounds like trouble. That was Arena's Winter Papers special on Wednesday. And there was more talk of cheating when Ray Darcy spoke to Australian singer Tim Minchin about his new album.
So you talk about being tempted by other women. That great line, her vodka-soaked lips only taste of the absence of you.
Yeah.
And the you being Sarah, I suppose, your wife.
Yeah, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely writing about the experience of being on tour and in New York. And when you're me and you're in New York, that when you know, we used to live in England and when you go to New York, as I'm sure you've experienced, you're up all night because of the time difference. And when you're you've got a musical on Broadway, of course, you're quite
popular.
Your ego can get a little bit inflated, out of control, yes, right? Because Americans are so happy to just absolutely. There's none of this Irish irony. They're just like really kind and really nice and really complimentary. Whereas if the Irish like you, they just sort of tell you you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, everyone's fawning over you and you're up all night and, you know, drinking. And I've definitely been in a situation where I've gone, oh God, I'm, you know, there's truth in the story of me kissing a girl or a girl kissing me and thinking, well, what am I doing this for? But it's...
So you married Sarah, who you met at university.
Yeah. I married my first girlfriend. The girl I lost my virginity to.
Yes.
It's so great to be on Irish radio and talking about temptation and virginity. It's like, of course.
You took the call. That was your first mistake. But Tim Minchin was not going to write about unicorns and rainbows and love hearts. For him, love meant death and decline.
I, as a person who really likes women and likes a drink and has a fragile ego, so I get puffed up and feel good about myself. And, you know, I am obviously susceptible. I could be that guy. The cheaty ass, you know. So I have to make a decision, right? And similarly, she could be really paranoid and jealous. And, of course, she could cheat and have an affair as well. So there's these choices to make, right? And no one writes about these things. But this is the very essence of love. Just like in my song Apart Together, I talk about the fact that love is about watching each other decay over time. These are the truths of it. So sure, we can write romantic pop songs, but I think it's my job to write the other ones, the missing ones, you know, ones about what it's really like.
Yeah, you say you said in an interview there that's it. When you sign up, when you commit to somebody, that the beauty is that you are going to watch each other die and decay. And
fall apart, yeah. I mean, it's brutal, right?
It is brutal, yeah, it is.
Dimension with Ray to think this is the fun section of Playback. Well, we're almost at a finish, and with the eye on the Christmas arrangements, perhaps going out for a meal, a few thoughts on keeping COVID safe. Here's the HSE's Paul Reid.
So firstly, for this weekend, it's not just about in restaurant, it's as people travel to restaurants or travel to meet together or travel together or indeed leave together. And people's guard can understandably drop, maybe after a glass or two of wine, or as people leave each other and may not see each other for Christmas, and our natural inkling is to hug each other and wish each other Happy Christmas, which, as we know, in the current environment is extreme risk.
So a no-hugging rule, backed up by infectious diseases consultant Paddy Mallon with Clare yesterday.
We really need to keep our hugs for Christmas Day and for our family. We really don't need to hug our close friends to show them how much we like them, and I think they'll understand that for the next few weeks.
Gotcha. Over on Drive Time, Sarah asked consultant in infectious diseases Dr. Cleanani Hialli this question.
If you had one piece of advice then for people listening who are planning to spend time with family but are, you know, concerned about it and wanting to do the right thing and the best thing between now and then, what would be your best piece of advice for them?
Open the windows.
So, sitting on your own in the freezing cold, and when Professor of Architecture Orla Hegarty spoke to Clare, she too advocated opening the windows and the doors and added this to the mix.
Indoor singing should not be permitted anywhere at the moment, whether it's at Christmas religious services or in people's homes. If you're going to sing, do it outside.
Okay, so no singing, no laughing, no shouting, unless you have to speak over the extractor fan, but you must have your mask on. It's going to be great crack.
Oh, it's going to be something, all right. Well, that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And as for the no singing, not everyone got the memo. Talk to you next week. Whoa!